So, welcome to the Center's annual lecture series. This is the last installment for 2005. The first installment in 2006 will feature our own Bernie Goldstein, who will be speaking on the philosophy of Ptolemaic astronomy. That's on Friday, January 20th, same place, same time. Our speaker today is Michael Dietrich from Dartmouth College. He was trained as a philosopher of science. He has a PhD in philosophy from UCSD. His academic perch is in the Department of Biological Sciences at Dartmouth, and he works in the history of biology. So I imagine that his New Hampshire license plate reads not live free or die, but live interdisciplinary or die. Just to tell you a bit about his current research projects, he's developing a website on the history of molecular evolution that's part of the history of recent science and technology on the Internet Project. He's finishing a biography of Richard Goldschmidt and researching the fate of various biologists who were forced to flee Nazi Germany. And one of his abiding interests centers on how molecular biology has influenced attitudes towards natural selection. And so today we're going to hear about how molecular biology has led to the demise of panselections. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you for having me out today. Today I would like to talk about the impact that molecular biology has had on evolutionary biology by talking about the rise and fall of panselectionism. First, a couple words about molecular evolution. This is an any-side-up diagram of molecular evolution. Any-side-up diagrams were first used in the 1920s to diagram genetics. I did this one for molecular evolution because it captures the multidisciplinary nature of molecular evolution. It's an any-side-up diagram because no single perspective is privileged, so you have to rotate the diagram. And if you go to the website, you can press little buttons that make it spin around. The way you read it is the object of study is in the innermost circle, so for molecular evolution, proteins, DNAs, and RNAs. These are more or less disciplinary perspectives, and then on this sort of medium-level ring, you get theories, models, controversies that are related to the disciplinary perspective and, of course, to the object of inquiry. Today I'm going to be focusing on this aspect over here, in other words, the part of molecular evolution that comes out of an evolutionary genetic tradition, and in particular on the neutralist and selectionist theories of genetic variability. In particular, what I want to do is focus on a particular kind of story that they tell about their own history. So this is the most recent incarnation, and by recent I mean October of this year. So Alexei Kondrashov says, once upon a time, the world seemed simple when viewed through the eyes of evolutionary biologists. All genomes were tightly controlled by various forms of natural selection. The idyllic world began to crumble in 68 when Kimura made his modest proposal that most allele substitutions and polymorphisms were in fact neutral or governed by random drift. This is the basic sort of nutshell version of what happens when you get molecular biology coming into evolution. Rise of the neutral theory and the displacement of pan-selectionism, or the idea that it was selection all the time at every level. So what did Kimura say? Well, in 1968, he and Tomoko Ota, who's this person over here, used some of the very first protein sequence data about comparisons between hemoglobin sequences within mammals, to calculate how fast those molecules were evolving. So what they did is they counted the numbers of differences between hemoglobin chains, and they calculated the rate of evolution. There was a big problem, though. It produced a cost of selection, because it was assumed that most changes are bad for you. If you have a high rate of evolution, you're accumulating deleterious mutations, and it takes a long time to get rid of them, especially if they're recessive. So the faster your rate of evolution, the higher your cost of selection. The rate of evolution they calculated was so high that there should be no mammals alive on Earth. Okay? So something had to be wrong with that. What was wrong with it, Kimura said, is they're assuming that everything is selected. If most of those variants, most of those changes that are occurring are neutral, they have no selective difference one way or another, then the cost of selection lowers and everything's okay. Okay? So this is what he proposes in 68. Very quickly thereafter, he starts to back this up with other pieces of evidence. The most biochemical piece of evidence is that for synonymous mutations. So, as you undoubtedly remember from your genetics class, you have a triplet DNA code produces different amino acids. The redundancy in the table can be explained by synonymous changes in the third position. In other words, it doesn't matter what you have over here. If you have U and U in the first position, let's find one of the two. U and E, it's serines all the time. Okay? So that means these can change and have no effect whatsoever on the protein. That means selection cannot see this, so they have to be neutral. Okay? That's a pretty straightforward piece of biochemical evidence that should show you that at least a third of your DNA is roughly neutral. Okay? The year after Kimura publishes his paper, King and Jukes publish a paper that has much, much more evidence. It uses the same cost of selection argument. It includes synonymous mutations. It appeals to things like the molecular clock, differences in amino acid compositions. This really sets off the neutralist selectionist controversy. It does so first because it brings together a huge amount of biochemical evidence. But mostly the thing that does it is its title. The paper is titled Non-Darwinian Evolution. It's published in Science. It's meant to piss off old people. Okay? And it does a great, great job. The people it pisses off especially are the establishment people within evolutionary biology. So the people that design the evolutionary synthesis, Dobzhansky, Meyer, and Simpson. So they issue the challenge. Darwinians respond very quickly. Roland Richman and Brian Clark both write almost exhaustive review articles that address these two point by point. This is really the first salvo. Very quickly after, they organize a meeting at Harvard in Boston. And then the 1971 Berkeley meeting are actually the first face-to-face confrontations we get between the neutralists and selectionists. What's going to happen after this is that, or what I'm going to try to convince you of is that there's a whole lot of stuff going on in the course of these controversies. And what we need to do is sort of parse it out and figure out why it persists. So I'm going to say that the neutralist selectionist controversy is, in fact, three controversies in one. Initially, there is a molecular morphological split. In other words, there's a debate about what level is being discussed. In other words, is this evolution only at the molecular level, or does this include evolution at the morphological level, or the organismic level? That is going to get compounded by arguments about what's going on in proteins, and then what's going on at the DNA level. DNA data doesn't become readily available until after the 80s. So before then, from 68 into the 80s, the most common sources of data are going to be usually through indirect measures of protein variation. There's some protein sequencing going on, but it's painful and hard to do. So you use indirect measures, measures of things like immunological compatibility, or you use electrophoresis, which measures differences in chunks of molecules by charge and size. So let me go through these controversies a little bit. The molecular morphological controversy is ignited by the molecular clock. The molecular clock was announced by Emil Zuckerkandel and Linus Pauling, both, of course, biochemists and chemists. What they did is they produced these initial sequences of hemoglobins. They then charted those relative to time. When they did that, they discovered that the differences seemed to progress or accumulate in what looks like a rate constant fashion. In other words, they're changing in a constant way. Pauling encouraged Zuckerkandel to be outrageous with this, and so Zuckerkandel says, this is a molecular clock, and the name sticks. It becomes immediately controversial. Most morphological evolutionists hate this idea. And in particular, they hate diagrams like this. This is the most sort of iconic diagram. It's a straight line diagram which sort of shows you that for each molecule, cytochromes, hemoglobins, and fibrin and peptides, you would expect a constant rate of change over time. So all you have to do is find any molecule you want, and it's going to have a constant rate of change. In evolution with organisms, you should never get a constant rate of change, because evolution is mediated by the environment. As you can see, the environment is not constant. So why would you expect evolutionary change to be constant? Yet at the molecular level, it's always constant, okay, at the protein level. This sets off a huge argument. G.G. Simpson, the great paleontologist, says that molecules cannot have evolved by an internal constant rate mutational process. It has to be an irregular and adaptive way. He wants molecules to behave just like any other evolutionary feature. One of the first places where Emil Zukerkandel expresses this idea is at a special conference in Austria. At that conference are Dobzhansky, Meyer, and Simpson. After Zukerkandel presents his paper, they pull him aside into a little room and lock the door. And they try to teach him what evolution is all about. It does zero good whatsoever. Okay? But you're going to see they're going to continue to try to discipline the molecular people. They say, yes, there's some tension, but what counts to us most is actually uncovering molecular mechanisms that underlay the observations of classical biology. Now, if you know anything about the history of molecular biology, you know that this is not nice, okay? To call someone classical has the connotation of being old-fashioned, out of touch, out of date, non-experimental, and non-funded, okay? So this is the beginning of symptomatic of a larger fight. They have exchanges in print about, Bristol's calling each other stamp collectors, the organism people are the stamp collectors, or the butterfly collectors, which isn't much better than stamps. Dobzhansky, Simpson, Meyer call the molecular people faddists on a bandwagon. You may remember that in E.O. Wilson's little biography, he calls Jim Watson the Caligula of biology. Okay, that's all part of this exchange. What makes it tied to the molecular clock is that Zukerkandel and Pauling are trying to figure out what makes that clock constant. On one level, they say it could be selection. On the other, it could be drift. By 68, when the neutral theory has been proposed, Moto Kimura, Alan Wilson, and other people start to push for that neutralist explanation. The reason why that's appealing is that using the expectation that drift, so random fluctuation, is the only thing affecting the processes of substitution, means that if mutation is a random process, then that means that the substitutions you accumulate should be a random process. So under the neutral theory, without any interference from selection, molecules act just like radioactive clocks. They act just like a random, perfectly random process. And so you would expect that they, unless something comes in and changes that fundamental mechanism, the process is going to continue as it always has. Alan Wilson banks on this, and he produces this thing called the molecular morphological paradox. The paradox says, look, molecular evolution is constant. Organismal evolution is not. This is the threat, okay? In other words, there's a big difference brewing here between what goes on the molecular level and what goes on the morphological level. Now remember, for evolutionary biologists, they had just established the evolutionary synthesis. This was the thing that unified all of biology, that made biology different from chemistry and physics, right? Because chemistry and physics is not about evolved entities. So they think that they have unified all of biology. And yet here's this split occurring. Moreover, it's a split with ramifications for funding, prestige, everything within the discipline. So there's the threat, and here's the resolution. Alan says that you can resolve the paradox by postulating random fixations of amino acids, so neutral mutations, okay? And so that'll have no effect whatsoever. In other words, what happens at the molecular level is that evolution is neutral, but at the organismal level, you can still have organismic natural selection occurring, okay? What's going on is that they divide the domain of biology, right? There's now molecular evolution and organismal evolution. And this is exactly what they want to do. Doing that this way makes molecular evolution distinct and interesting in its own right, but still compatible with organismal evolution, right? It's not necessarily contradictory. It's just there's different processes going on at each level. If you want unification, however, that is not satisfying. If you want Meyer, Dobzhansky, and Simpson to stop yelling at you, this is very satisfying, okay? So they divide the levels, the domain. This, they hope, will help ease that split between molecular and morphological levels. And indeed, part of the early sort of very negative reaction to the neutral theory is that people misunderstood that. They thought that Kimura was advocating random drift all the way up, and he was not. He was always very specific. This is drift only at the level of proteins and DNA, never at higher levels. But earlier in the 20th century, there had been many, many debates about the possibility of drift to explain things like banding patterns in snails or other organismal phenomena. With that confusion aside, it looks like the split will allow these different levels to recede. So we get explanations for divergent rates, the existence of the molecular clock at the molecular level, and an irregular adaptive evolution at the organismal level. This slide just summarizes a lot of the arguments that are going on. We could go through all of them, maybe, if you want to. The important thing here is that neither side is being perfectly reductionist or anti-reductionist with each other. They're offering different strategies for saying that they are compatible with each other. This one over here, the molecular strategy for evolution, is to say that you have the divided domain, natural selection on one level, and drift on the other. So why does the neutralist selectionist controversy persist? After the mid-70s, it's no longer this debate about what level evolution is occurring on. Instead, it's a debate about what's going on within the molecular level, especially with the protein and DNA kinds of data. It becomes a problem of explaining polymorphisms and a problem of explaining rate constancy for the molecular clock. Now, polymorphism is the key issue here, and it's very important to understand why, what it is they're trying to explain. Everybody assumes that this is what happens. A new mutation occurs. The mutation is either going to be good for you, in which case selection drives it to fixation. It makes it spread throughout the entire population. That happens very fast. Chances are you are not going to witness that process. Okay? That's how fast it's going to happen. Or it could be really, really bad for you, like it could kill you. Chances are you're not going to witness that process either. Okay? So if it's really good for you or really bad for you, you're not going to see it. Okay? And that's not what they're explaining. Polymorphisms are variabilities or changes, different forms that persist in the population. So those would be things that are neutral, because neutral things are not necessarily going to go to fixation or loss very quickly. Or they're going to be things that are very weakly selected, or they're going to be things that are selected in balance with other gene combinations. So the problem is to explain what you detect, not what actually happens. Okay, so polymorphism is what you epistemically have access to in terms of genetic variability. That's important because some people think the neutral theory is about all drift all the time. It's not. They assume a huge, I mean huge amount of natural selection. It's only what's left after selection is done that you then use drift to explain part of. Okay? So for both protein and DNA disputes, these are both what are called relative frequency controversies. In particular, what's being debated are the relative proportion or importance of neutral mutations, and of course the relative proportions of random drift. Because you always have a selection drift mix, it's not the case that someone's saying it's all drift and all selection. It's about the relative proportions of drift and selection in both of these specific controversies. This polarization is, of course, most severe in the early period. So this is just a citation analysis of the original Kane and Jukes paper in blue and the Kimura paper in red. The dotted lines show you the actual curves without self-citation. They're very good at promoting themselves, so they cited themselves often. But you see in this early period, what you have is a huge response. During this time period, the controversy is polarizing. People are adopting extreme positions that they actually know in their heart of hearts could not ever be true, okay? The controversy polarizes as people say it's all selection or it's almost all drift all the time. Notice almost all of them initially are responding to the King and Jukes paper. That's because that's where actually all the biochemical evidence was to respond to. The Kimura paper, by comparison, is actually relatively impoverished. Yet down here by 1980, you get a switch in the citation pattern. That's because Kimura takes over the propaganda machine for the neutral theory. And so by the 90s, the person you associate with the theory is not the people that produced the data, but the person who continued its advocacy. So So what kind of a split do we have? The neutralists call themselves non-Darwinians to pick a fight. The people they don't like are called naive and selectionists. Okay? These are the terms they use when the controversy is most polarized. This also corresponds to a polarization between levels, molecular and organismal, at the same time, with the selectionist favoring a unified approach, the molecular advocates advocating a pluralistic or a multi-factor approach. Theodor Dostoevsky is a very interesting person in this light. He watches the controversy polarize at the end of his career. He's an architect of the modern synthesis, so he helps set up the unified program in the first place. But he is a drifter, okay? As in, he advocated random drift for a key part of his career, notably in the 1930s when he's articulating the evolutionary synthesis. In the 40s, he decides he's going to focus on balancing selection or heterozygous superiority. The historical problem is, does he then think that drift is not important? Or does he just think balancing selection is really cool and that's what I'm going to do? John Beatty has argued, I think fairly convincingly, that he just thought balancing selection was really cool and that's what he's going to do. So when the neutral theory comes up, he has sort of mixed feelings about it. And in fact, he writes to Jack King, who's a population geneticist, and tries to convince him that he's an old drifter and that Jack King ought to believe what Dobzhansky believes. But of course, if you know a lot about Dobzhansky, you should know that he's very polished and very good at getting his own way. Right? So this is how he does it. This is a three-page letter to Jack King following the Boston meeting. So in Boston, Jack King was given the job of representing the neutralist position, mostly because it's really expensive to fly Kimura and Ota all the way from Japan to come to this meeting. King is wavering, and so Dobzhansky wants to sort of get in there and change him. And so he says, what I wanted to say is that you're not constrained to be a non-Darwinian as others are by their past sins. It's plain to me that Kimura and Crow have embraced the notion of the prevalence of neutral mutations since they've given proof that polymorphisms cannot be as numerous as they are and evolution has not been as vast as it is. You are surely not in this predicament. And so what he's trying to do is to say, look, you don't have to go over to the dark side. There's people like me that have always believed in a little bit of drift, okay? And so you can just become just like me. And it's true, Dobzhansky had always believed in a little bit of drift, okay? And never had to get rid of it. But of course, this is not a genuine thing because the rest of the three-page letter goes on to demolish the neutral theory. He goes through basically every piece of evidence that he presented in a fairly detailed way, the Trefler mutations, the amino acid frequencies, and then he ends up sort of saying, look, don't hold it against Roland Richman, remember, one of the people who attacked King and Chu. And he says, basically, that you've done a useful service to evolution, but the phenomenon you stress is going to actually turn out to be a minor one rather than a major one, right? So once again, you get Dobzhansky sort of offering just a little bit. Yeah, you can have a little bit of drift, but look, just put it in perspective, okay? It's a little bit of drift, not a lot of drift. And so it's a way of sort of disciplining not only Tom Ju, but also of the place of molecular evolution relative to everything else going on in evolutionary biology at the same time. It actually works for King a little bit. He actually does throttle back a fair bit. Others do not. They are not nearly as ambiguous as King was. Kimura, if anything, becomes more determined in his advocacy of the neutral theory. And that could be in part because there were some very nasty nationalist politics. The idea that the neutral theory was espoused mostly by Japanese researchers had some fairly racist reactions from English and American researchers. One of the things that contributes to this is the idea of specific testing. At the Berkeley Conference in 1971, Kimura and Tomoko Oda say, look, it doesn't matter whether you really like the theory and think it's true. We're producing testable quantitative predictions. If you don't like it, test it and reject it, which seems like a fairly reasonable attitude. At the same conference, Guy Ledyard Stebbins, a botanist, and Richard Lewontin, evolutionary geneticist, say no. The neutral theory is empirically void because it has no potential falsifiers. This is actually from a very long discussion of Popperian method in evolutionary biology. The reason they think it has no potential falsifiers is not because it's not producing testable predictions. They have to admit that. The problem is they can't win with it producing testable predictions because none of the tests turn out to be decisive. So throughout all of the 1970s, there's lots and lots of work trying to produce quantitative predictions and statistical tests. The most famous one is Warren Ewens from the Berkeley meeting, who's Warren's a brilliant mathematician who comes up with the sampling formula that you need to actually figure out how to test it statistically. It turns out that the data that you can get from electrophoresis is not good enough, and so the test has no statistical power. Extremely frustrating if you're a neutralist or a selectionist. Lewontin and Krakauer propose a test. Perhaps the most famous is Francisco Ayala's. He has a test for the distribution of variability within a population. He measures in that test an excess of rare alleles that doesn't fit with the prediction of the neutral theory. The neutral theory, rather than going, ah, you're right, forget it, in a very sort of naive Popperian way, says, wait, and they tweak about three things, and they're alive and going again, which is sort of exactly what a philosopher of science would expect. The biologists didn't expect that. They wanted people to roll over and go away. Instead, what you get is a huge amount of ad hoc revisionism. The neutral theory continues to develop, becomes much more sophisticated in the way it frames itself. The key part for the controversy is that protein data doesn't resolve anything. Chris Wills, a biologist at UC San Diego, entered the debate in 1973 with this article, in defense of naive pan-selectionism. In part, he took up Kimura and Ota's challenge and defended the most extreme position he could, namely that every change is selected, and it's just a matter of trying to find out what they are. To try to convince you of that, what he did is start to produce these diagrams of variation. So the top bar represents all of the possible mutations that could occur. The ones over here in the shaded area are harmful. Those are eliminated, so they're negatively selected. Out of the remaining ones, these are harmful ones that are recessive or not fully expressed. They'll be eliminated much more slowly. Out of the remainder over there, you get some that are slightly adaptive. So they're going to linger in the population, but then probably either get fixed or eliminated. Out of the remaining portion, this tiny little bit over here is positively selected, good for you all the time. And then here's different ones that are preserved for different kinds of considerations, different kinds of selective scenarios that would preserve those, mostly balancing selection because of how they combine with other genes. Notice there's no neutral variance in there at all. So when you parse out all of the kinds of variability that could occur, there are nothing is left to be selected or not selected at all. The neutralists respond to this immediately by trying to show you that, in fact, most of this up here is, in fact, neutral. So it's naive pan-selectionist in that everything, every possible mutation that you can find is going to be selected for some reason or another. Not convincing, but I think instead of trying to go through the virtues and vices of it, I take this as evidence of what's happening during this period of extreme polarization. It's not that Chris Wills, I think, actually really believed that. Certainly by the 1980s, he no longer believed that. Instead, he's articulating a position as part of an extremely polarized controversy. During that time period, Kimura was no better. He would say things like, all substitutions are neutral. And that's, in other publications, he was much more careful about that. Most biologists at this time acknowledge a minor role for drift. Okay? Even if they're saying, like Dobzhansky, that it's going to be a very, very small role for drift. So none of them, even Chris Wills, I think, was actually a naive pan-selectionist during this time period. This starts to change, or actually the whole controversy starts to change when we get the introduction of DNA sequences. This is Marty Kreitman. Marty Kreitman came to work with Richard Lewontin at Harvard. Out of the Lewontin lab, or I guess you should know, Lewontin is a student of Dobzhansky. He is an evolutionary geneticist. He was hired by Meyer to come in and heal the split between molecular and organismal biologists at Harvard. So at Harvard, the departments had split. okay? The organismal biologists got that nice old building, the Museum of Comparative Zoology, whereas the brand new state-of-the-art building across the street was where the molecular biologists moved, okay? Meyer wants these two factions to come back together. So they build the MCZ labs, which is actually connected by a glass walkway to the old building. Lewontin gets an entire floor in that lab empty, and it's his job to fill it. Lewontin, because he knows he has to heal that split, designs his lab so that you walk through the molecular bench space before you can get to anybody's offices in on that entire floor, right? Is this a good thing to do? Well, the safety office did not think it was a good thing to do because they're doing electrophoresis, which means they're running huge electric currents across gels. So they were constantly trying to get them to close like these giant sliding doors so that no one would walk in and electrocute themselves. But Lewontin said they explicitly decided to do this so that everybody who walked in would know they're in a molecular biology lab before they got to anybody's office. Okay? So it's this is where Kreitman comes out of. Kreitman, though, doesn't do electrophoresis. By the time the 80s roll around, electrophoresis is known to only measure a small proportion of the actual genetic variability. Instead, he goes to Wally Gilbert's lab and learns how to sequence DNA. Kreitman happens to be very, very good at this because he's very, very good with his hands. At that time, DNA sequencing was not automatic. There are no PCR machines. You know, you actually have to have skills to do it. And you have to have skills to do it reliably and well. Kreitman sequences 11 different species, okay? I think at that time they said that was like 20% of the Drosophila sequences that had been produced by Kreitman alone, okay? So he's very, very good at it. He sequences alcohol dehydrogenase. Alcohol dehydrogenase was known to have a fast and slow variant on electrophoresis. What he wants to know is how do you explain that polymorphism you can detect at the DNA level. So, to try to get at this, as part of the HRST project, we took the Sloan Foundation's money and we gave Dick Lewontin a big long list of questions and we made him go talk to Marty Kreitman. And the result is a huge interview where Kreitman actually describes everything he did and everything he didn't actually learn from Lewontin and did learn from Wally Gilbert and other things like that. But what he says is that what he wants to do is figure out the hidden variation at the protein level. They know electrophoresis is missing probably 70% of the genetic variability. So when he does it, he says, look, we find lots of variation, but of course we knew that there was going to be lots of variation there. But what they figured out was that selective constraints were leaving a signature in that genetic variability. In other words, with molecules, you would expect that some parts of the molecules are going to be so highly selective that they will never, ever change. Other parts, it don't matter so much. And so those can change much more often. What they do with these first DNA sequences is they start to see the signatures of those selective constraints. And in particular, what they start to do is to measure the distribution of nucleotide variability. Kreitman, working with statisticians, then figures out that you can measure differences in synonymous and non-synonymous changes, so selective versus non-selective changes, within species and between species, and produce a very reliable statistical test, so TAS power, to detect selection in different molecules. The result is the HKA test, which then very quickly afterward, as more DNA data becomes available, produces the Tajima D, McDonald, Kreitman, and a whole host of others. What this does is it literally changes your ability to detect selection and neutrality, even with very different situations. Different situations where you have independent sites or linked sites, skewed population structures, whatever you want. This is currently the state of the art in the post-genomic era, using statistical tests of this sort to measure neutrality and selection. So this is another citation graph. Here's the original ADH, pretty predictable. These are the two statistical tests. Notice they keep going up, 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 up. Okay? They are now the major means for detecting selection and neutrality. This also corresponds to a depolarization of the controversy. When you find people using neutrality and drift measurements from these kinds of statistical tests, they don't say, ha, detected selection, therefore the neutral theory is wrong. they say, ha, detected selection, isn't that interesting? Okay, in my particular promoter region or in my particular molecule. This corresponds, I think, also to a generational shift. Okay, Kimura is dead. He died here in 1994. Okay, and we all know that that's a very reliable way of closing a controversy, which is to kill the major combatants. Right after that, though, this younger generation just doesn't care as much about the global picture. They're usually interested in their organism, their genes, and in their particular molecular problem. As a result, they're not engaging in a wider dispute. The wider dispute's there, and they usually gain traction from it, but they're much more interested in applying this test to their specific circumstance. So I don't want to say that the controversy is resolved or closed, rather that it's depolarized. You don't have extreme positions, and you don't have the same kind of engagement that you had definitely in the early 1970s. As a result of this, Jim Crow, who was Kimura's advisor, mentor, and close friend, declares in 1987 that the controversy is closing. And he says, but look, what the neutral theory has done for us is that it has provided a null model. In other words, in 1974 or 64, Kimura and Crow used neutral alleles before there's any evidence for their empirical existence as a kind of instrumental use only. In other words, it's easy to do the math for population genetics when S equals zero, when there's no selection. And so you always did it the easy way before you did it the hard way. That's one form of a null model. Post-85, they're using it as an empirical null model. In other words, a null model about the way the world is actually structured. After 85, if you use a McDonald-Kreitman test, if you use any of those statistical tests for DNA data, you're assuming neutrality as a fact about your sequence until it's disproven by the statistical test. Okay? This is a huge reversal from what had preceded it just a decade ago. So I want to move off a little bit into answering the bigger question. To what extent does the neutral theory contribute to the decline of pan-selectionism, and in what sense does this render evolution more pluralistic? Well, to do that, we're going to have to figure out what pan-selectionism really means. So the way I approach this is by adapting Peter Godfrey Smith's threefold distinctions concerning adaptationism. So Peter says, look, you can talk about empirical, methodological, or explanatory adaptationism. So empirical says natural selection is a powerful and ubiquitous force. There are few constraints except general and obvious ones on the biological variation that fuels it. Remember, adaptation is positive selection. Methodological, the best way to see or to understand a biological system is to look for features of adaptation and good design. And then explanatory, explaining the apparent designs of organisms and the relations of adaptiveness between organisms is the core intellectual mission of evolutionary theory. We can adapt those to be pan-selectionist. Pan-selection is importantly different because not everything is positive selection, right? So you have to include negative selection as well. The thing here is that you don't have to change the first one at all, right? Pan-selection still assumes that natural selection is a powerful and ubiquitous force. Methodologically, though, it's very different. Instead of looking for adaptation and design, you're looking for any evidence of natural selection in a huge range of forms. Explanatorily, you want to explain those effects of selection as the core intellectual mission of evolutionary theory. So now we can go through these three forms of pan-selection to figure out what's changed in the molecular realm. Empirical pan-selectionism, in its extreme formulation of all selection all the time at the molecular level or morphological level, certainly that's rejected, but I'm not sure it was ever actually held, except maybe by Chris Wills in one article, but I think that was more rhetorical than actual. So in some ways, I don't think we've ever had a strong empirical pan-selectionism to be rejected. That said, you probably get a lot more people more readily agreeing to that today than you would have in 1972. The key here is the importance of the relative frequency issue. Because it's a relative frequency debate, there is no diametrically opposed position. Almost everybody knew that it was going to be a mix of drift and selection. The question is, what mix do you settle on? I think this also depends on what level you're talking about and the age of the participants. Younger participants seem to be much happier with a mix of drift and selection. Older ones don't. In fact, they keep having conferences to talk about the end of the neutralist selectionist controversy. So they just had one at the Stazione in Naples, I guess about 5 years ago. And so they all said, yes, we're going to end the controversy, end the controversy. And so right after that controversy, I was talking to Francisco Ayala, and I said, so did the controversy end? Oh, yes, it's over, it's over. Who won? Oh, we did, of course. And you know, one question, and the controversy is back, okay? But Francisco Ayala was an original on that. When I asked the same question of younger people, the answer was, who cares? Okay, I don't care. I'm not going to fight a controversy for the rest of my life. I'm going to do interesting work. Methodologically. Methodological pan-selection was attacked in the famous Gould and Lewontin Spandrels of San Marco paper. There they say they're attacking an adaptationist position. One reading of that is to say that they're arguing for a kind of pluralism about evolutionary forces, namely that random drift has to have some impact. There's a levels ambiguity in that paper. Are they saying drift is important at the morphological level or the molecular level? I think Gould meant the morphological level. I think Lewontin knew exactly what he was talking about and meant the molecular level. Regardless of how we want to read that, we can debate that. Pan-selectionism was defended by Meyer very quickly afterward. He said, not only is it the best method available, it's the only method available because you can never epistemically detect drift. Okay? But remember, Meyer's an old guy. He's an organismal guy. Okay? I think when he's saying things like that, he's referring to things like the debate over snail banding patterns, not about what's going on with proteins or DNA at the same time. I think the post-85 neutrality test definitively eliminate methodological pan-selectionism. And I don't mean modify, I mean eliminate it. Okay? The starting methodological assumption when you're dealing with a piece of DNA sequence is neutrality. You then reject neutrality to get selection. That is a complete methodological reversal at the molecular level from what you would have had in 1968. And lastly, explanatory pan-selectionism. Richard Dawkins in Universal Darwinism argued that it's adaptation all the time. So this is the core intellectual mission part of Peter's definition. Right? What's evolution about? Explaining adaptations. Well, maybe for Richard Dawkins. Okay? For the rest of evolutionary biology, there's been a few other things that have been examined. Richard Dawkins here, it's important to understand this article is an article arguing against creationists. Okay? And so I think that explains why he's saying it's adaptationism all the time. Adaptations are the key thing to focus on. If you believe that, though, then most of population genetics doesn't make sense. Sewell Wright definitely doesn't make sense. God knows what he was doing. Dobzhansky, most evolutionary population geneticists don't make sense because there's a ton of stuff going on that's not just about adaptations. In fact, Dawkins actually says the neutral theory can be ignored. It's not important, right? Because it's not about adaptation. How can it ever be about adaptation? And so he says that's simply not significant. That's not a significant factor in evolutionary. Rather than get into the pros and cons, I think this is a straightforward struggle for authority. They're trying to define, or trying to struggle about who's going to get to define the key questions in the field. Dawkins thinks he gets to do it. I would say Moto Kimura is definitely trying to define what he thinks are the key issues. And the way Kimura does it, though, is much more clever, much less heavy-handed than Dawkins. Kimura, by dividing the domain, creates his own domain where his explanation is the primary explanation. And then he leaves the dregs of adaptationism with all its foibles to people like Richard Dawkins. Okay? There's one way of solving that struggle for authority, but it comes with a price. Molecular evolution is now distinct and separate from organismal evolution. You get two domains isolated by level. They're not completely isolated. They're still exchanging bits of information. But the core explanatory problem is said to be different because of their different objects of research. That split, at one hand, was embraced by people like Kimura, and then it troubled him deeply, too, because it also meant that he could be marginalized. Oh, you're just doing molecular evolution. And Kimura actually was ambitious enough to want the whole enchilada. Okay? And so at the end of his career, he always was trying to find out how to make neutral mutations relevant to phenotypic or adaptive change. He's never actually solved how to do that. That solution is actually going on today. The way that this is getting addressed is through evolutionary developmental genetics. So I want to end by just showing you a really cool example of how that bridge between levels is being integrated in a specific explanation. The case here is of HSP90. It's heat shock protein 90, or 90 in us, it's heat shock protein 83 in Drosophila. This is a very cool article. This is by Suzanne Rutherford and Susan Lindquist, where they say that HSP90 is a capacitor for morphological evolution. HSP90 is a chaperone molecule. It exists to chaperone signaling molecules. In other words, to make sure that the signal transduction pathways flow freely and that messages get transported throughout, literally molecular messages get transported throughout the thing. What HSP90 does is it grabs onto a signaling molecule and it stabilizes it. In other words, it makes sure that its 3D conformation remains correct for it to have high chemical activity. What that means is that the molecule that's being chaperoned could have defects in it. It could have amino acid changes that make it unstable without the chaperone. The chaperone comes along and sort of props it up, keeps it in the right 3D conformation so that it can do its job. What happens when you eliminate HSP90? When you did that with Drosophila, all of these different mutant forms pop up, right? You get a huge burst of phenotypic diversity. That diversity had always been there. It had always been in the proteins that were being propped up, that were being stabilized by the HSP. When you add in the chemical that inhibits HSP production, suddenly you get this burst of phenotypes appearing. That's why they call it an evolutionary capacitor. It's storing morphological difference, okay? What can knock out HSP? Well, stress knocks out HSP. Stress causes HSP to become overworked, and so it doesn't stabilize as many of these phenotypes as it had in the past, okay? And so the evolutionary explanation for HSP is a good adaptive one, right? Under periods of stress, maybe what you need to evolve is an expression of greater phenotypic diversity. So, handily, it's stored there, ready for you. You're not waiting for a mutation to occur. It's already occurred, and it's stored in its evolutionary capacitor. Okay? The key thing about it, though, is that HSP renders all of these protein-level changes perfectly neutral or silent, right? They're never expressed until HSP90 stops, right? So that means their frequency and their evolution within the population is governed only by neutral molecular evolution until HSP90 stops, okay? Under which case, then selection and its adaptive value kicks in. So it's a beautiful example of how neutral molecular evolution is being combined with adaptive or selective morphological evolution. All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Michael. We'll take a break for some wine and cheese before we resume for questions.